Jack WNST, Towson, Baltimore. And Baltimore Positive, we're having intelligent conversations around here, as always, brought to you and rebranded now as Wise Conversations with our partners at Wise Markets. And I'll be telling you about that all year long as we're eating better and spending less. And also the crab cake thing that I'm, and our guests will get into this in a couple of minutes, but it starts at Fadley's. They ship them all over the world. We probably would have had this guest down at Fadley's. We had him at State Fair last time. Evan over at State Fair says, oh, no, I got a crab cake in addition to the meatloaf he's not serving anymore. I'm getting on him about that, as well as those delicious chicken and waffles, the shrimp and grits, all of that. El Guapo across the street. We're going to be doing some eating and more eating, Don Moeller. Are we not on this crab cake thing?
We are, and we are delighted to welcome our good friend, CEO, Robin Hood Foundation, author, cable news commentator, jack of all trades, Wes Moore. Wes, welcome back to Baltimore Positive.
I'm so happy to be here. And all this talk about Fadley's and El Guapo has got me thinking about the best crab cakes, and you cannot exclude Coco's.
There's the question for you. We'll give you two or three. So you've got a couple of your buddies. You've been hobnobbing up there now in New York, running back and forth doing the Amtrak thing. So you got some friends come in from New York and they say, all right, Wes, over this weekend, we want to do a little crab cake thing in Baltimore. Where do you take them?
You got to take them to Coco's. You got to take them to Coco's. I mean, listen, and the one thing about Maryland, and you can tell folks, is that when they say, I'm going down to Maryland, where should I get the best crab cake? My honest answer is, it's difficult to find a bad one, right?
You know, Wes, Max Weiss was just on with us from Baltimore Magazine, and that was her. She said this. See if you agree with the first part of what she said. She said, I'm going to take it one step further. It's almost impossible to find a good crab cake outside of Maryland. It's almost impossible to find one that's not good in Maryland.
I second that wholeheartedly. And it's funny because when you go places that aren't in Maryland and it says like Maryland crab cake, I'm always like, who do I sue for libel for that one? Because well, I'm not getting a Maryland crab cake.
My sister. Go ahead, Nestor.
No, what happened for me is I had a family member come in and, you know, where do I send them? And people ask me all the time, where's the best? Where's my favorite? And I always say, gosh, I could give you a dozen places, right, where Coco's being one of them. I haven't been to Coco's in 20 years. And I want to go out and try new places and new things. The one thing I know, and you know this, they'll all be different. People say, well, you talk about Costas's crab cakes or Fadley's crab cakes or Green Mountain Station. Like, go to all of them. They're completely different. There's no two alike.
And they all just have their own special kick to it. They all have their own special, you know, uniqueness to it. But the thing that you know about it is they're not just all going to be done with a real sense of love, but it's a real sense of uniqueness, because this really is something that this state takes very seriously. So whether you're talking about, you know, the Point in Arnold has great ones. Kentler's Riverside has great ones, but you're never going to find a bad option.
And he's just throwing them out. And that's all I'm looking to do.
Nestor's going to do them. You know, you mentioned the out-of-state part, Wes. I still kid my sister. My sister grew up on the West Coast and then in Florida, but she visited a lot in Maryland. So she fancied herself somewhat of a crab cake connoisseur. So we're visiting her one day down in Florida, and we're out at a restaurant. She says, I know you have a rule. You have a hard and fast rule. You never order a crab cake when you're out of Maryland. I said, I do. I'm not ordering a crab cake out of Maryland. It won't be good. She goes, God, trust me. You know, I know Maryland, and I visit. And this is really a Maryland crab cake. You can break your rule. And I ordered it, and I just gave her one look, and it was like, sis, really, really? Come on, sis.
I had Rich Swanson on talking Dungeness crab with me this week, and I'm like,
What is that? All right, so crab cakes aside, Wes, not long ago, you made a big announcement that after years at the Robin Hood Foundation, it was time for Wes Moore to do something else. First of all, for folks who may not be familiar with Robin Hood and the incredible work that you and that foundation have done, bring us up to date and tell us what, when you think, when you look back, you'll be the most proud of.
Oof. You know, so Robinhood is a 32-year-old organization with an exclusive focus on ending poverty. It's one of the largest poverty fighting nonprofits inside of the U.S. And everywhere where poverty is either the cause or the consequence, whether we're looking at education, whether you're looking at housing, whether you're looking at transportation, whether you're looking at early childhood development, whether you're looking at criminal justice reform, you know, Robinhood has a history of finding and funding and building when necessary. Organizations that are really on the ground doing the work and in the fight. And I, when I think about the things that I wanted to get done when I first came to Robinhood, and it's an interesting story because I remember when Robinhood first approached me about becoming the CEO. And Nestor and Don, I told him, I said, my first gut reaction was, I don't think this, I'm not sure why you're coming to me for this. And I gave him multiple reasons, but the top three was, I said, one is, you know, I live in Baltimore and I'm a Marylander and the foundation is headquartered in New York. So I was like, I don't see, and I'm not moving. So I don't know why this makes sense.
Second, you went through that at State Fair because I thought you had moved.
That's right.
I think a lot of people thought you moved, right?
That's right. I literally was commuting every day. I was catching a 5:15 train and catching the train in the evening coming back home. I never wanted to leave. My family is here. And so I was very clear with them on that. The second piece was, you know, I was enjoying what I was doing. And the third piece, I said, listen, you know, I've actually been pretty critical of philanthropy historically. And in fact, the guy who ran the search firm at the time, he said, you know, it's all over the internet. We've seen it. So it's like, we've done our due diligence. And I was like, so why am I the person to come to on this? And his point was he said, because we think you actually might be right on a lot of things you're saying, and we want to test this out. And so I guess that goes back to the question of the things that I'm most proud of. I mean,
hey, Wes, before you jump into what you're most proud of, and I won't lose sight of that, but I'm intrigued by that. What were your criticisms over the years? And what did the guy mean when he said to you, you might be right?
Yeah. Well, I think oftentimes when I talk about the role of philanthropy in our society, and I say this first with a great deal of humility, because philanthropy changed my life. And it's not just because of the fact that we were recipients of philanthropic gifts and that kind of thing. But the reality is that, you know, the first job that my mom got, that was her first full-time job, was when I was 14 years old. It was the first job that gave her benefits. It was the first job that allowed her to work only one job instead of multiple part-time jobs. And that job was at a foundation. That job was at the Annie Casey Foundation, based down here in Mount Vernon in Baltimore. And so philanthropy literally changed my family's trajectory. And I'll always remember that and appreciate that. I also know that my challenge, my criticism of philanthropy is that, you know, philanthropy is not just about writing checks to good organizations. That, you know, there's a quote that actually sits on my desk from Dr. King. And that quote says, philanthropy is commendable, but the philanthropist can never forget the economic injustice that makes philanthropy necessary. Philanthropy has to do an honest audit of itself to understand, why do we need philanthropy? The reason that we support educational organizations is because we have an educational system that leaves too many kids behind. The reason that we have foundations and organizations that support housing security is because we have too many people who are housing insecure. The reason we have food and supporting people who are food insecure is because we've become satisfied with this idea of leaving people hungry. And so the thing that I wanted to challenge philanthropy to do is to say, you know, we are, you know, one of the largest in the country, or run a very large organization. But the reality is when you look at the largesse of philanthropy, even as big as all of philanthropy combined, it still does not amount to the size of the challenge that philanthropy is trying to solve. And that's really the mentality that you know, I've tried to take with my time at Robinhood. When people say you run one of the largest charities in the country, I say my challenge is, I don't run a charity. I don't believe in charity. I believe in change. I run one of the largest change organizations in the country. And so whether it was the fact that our organization, for the first time, we created a public policy arm in the first time in the history of the organization to ensure that we're leveraging our impact and tackling issues at their root, whether it was partnering with, you know, hundreds of nonprofits and community-based organizations, and that is also partnering with state and local and the federal government to impact change. Importantly and proudly, even though Robinhood has a New York headquarters, for the first time in the history of the organization, you know, we launched an initiative that actually focused on addressing poverty in urban, rural, and suburban areas. And we launched an initiative, a $25 million initiative called Mobility Labs. The first place that we started providing capital and these assets to ensure economic mobility was right here in Maryland. It was in Baltimore. And so we brought money back here. And so those are some of the things that I'm most proud of about this work as we're now looking at the, you know, at after 4.5 years looking to transition.
Well, you and again, if you're just joining us, we are with author, cable commentator, CEO, Robinhood, Wes Moore. And I promise you, for those of you listening, we will get into the what's next phase for Wes now that he's moving. He won't be getting on that train every day. At least we don't think he'll be getting on that train every day. Wes, talk a little bit. Every time you and I have spoken offline, the conversation always drifts toward child poverty. There is a fire that burns within you regarding childhood poverty, and you were passionate the last time we spoke. I don't think the Recovery Act had passed yet.
That's right.
It was about to pass, and you were passionate about its importance. Put a face on child poverty for folks who are listening.
Yeah. We, sometimes when people will say to me that poverty is a choice, and my honest answer back, when I look back at them, I say, you know what? You're right. Poverty is a choice. But it's not the choice of the individual who has the weight of poverty that sits on their shoulders. It's not like people wake up in the morning and say, yeah, this poverty thing is great, right? Poverty is a choice, but it's society's choice. It's how much pain are we willing to tolerate in our neighbors? How much pain are we willing to tolerate in people? And the thing that gets me so much about child poverty is the fact that we are allowing this measure of pain on our babies who have had no choice in this. It can't be their choice, but it shows itself in every single way in the air that we're asking people to breathe, in the water we're asking people to drink, in the homes we're asking people to live in the schools we're asking people to attend, in the way they're policed. All across the board, we see the way that this shows itself. And the reality is that it doesn't come without a cost. There's actually a cost to this. You know, the cost of child poverty to the U.S. economy every single year, it hovers between $800 billion and $1.1 trillion annually. And that's in terms of increased health expenditures, reduced adult economic productivity, and other factors. And so, you know, we've been pushing so hard on this, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say a huge thank you to President Biden, to Vice President Harris, to the Maryland congressional delegation who fought for this. What happened with the ARP, and specifically one clause, and it's a nuanced clause, but you're right, Don. It is actually one of the most important pieces of legislation in a generation in the way that we are thinking about child poverty was included in the rescue plan, and that is something called an adjustment to the child tax credit. For very quick background, what the child tax credit is, it was basically something that was passed to be able to deal with child poverty, right? To be able to make sure that children who are growing up under this weight of poverty have a chance to have access for the basic needs that can move them above the poverty line and give them a chance for sustainable economic growth. The challenge is that the child tax credit, as the way it was designed before, actually had an earn-in to it. Right. So there was an earn-in work requirement. So what was happening was there was about 27 million children in this country that were being left out because they were too deep into poverty. Right. An anti-poverty program.
They were too poor to qualify.
They were too poor to qualify. Right. They were too deep into poverty to qualify. Right. 27 million children who were saying this is an anti-poverty program. But by the way, you're too deep into poverty. to qualify for this, right? And so what happened with the child tax credit adjustment that happened was not only was there an increase to now it's $3,600 for children who are under the age of six annually, and then also $3,000 for children over the age of six that goes to, per child that goes to families. A couple other things happen. One is paid on a monthly basis and not on an annual basis, which is a really big deal for families, even that small slight adjustment. The other thing is this, to your point, Nestor, is it is now also fully refundable. What making that fully refundable means is we don't have that earn in clause, which now means with the stroke of a pen, we have almost halved child poverty in this country. In the stroke of a pen.
And now that sounds very political to me. How are we going to see that 18 months from now?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things I'm hoping to see 18 months from now. One is, you know, we are going to see that if you take a family, you know, take a family who has three children under the age of six, we're now increasing their monthly allowance of upwards of about $11,000. Right. And it can be used towards anything from educational supports. It can be used towards things like the basics of Pampers and diapers and food, other supports for the family after school programming, and particularly after coming off of a year that we just had where literally, you know, we're just getting briefed on a stat in Baltimore City where about 61% of ninth graders in Baltimore City right now are chronically absent. All right, because of this past year that we just had, we have got to come up with a way of reimagining our supports for our families who have been hit so hard by the consequences and the impacts of COVID-19 and the fact that there really hasn't been that collective response. And so the big thing we're also pushing for, Nestor, is that the clause and the adjustment that was made in that is going to be for about a year adjustment. The big push that we're now going to have, the next fight, is that we have to make it permanent.
Wes Moore is our guest here, the other Wes Moore, along with Don Moeller joining us here, former Baltimore County executive. I want to ask you, because it feels like a minute ago we were kind of hanging out, and I remember we did this in December, and we were celebrating the holidays. I mean, you were literally our holiday feel-good guest at Christmas time, December 9th, 2019. 2020 was a hell of a year for everybody, right? So, you know, I would say for change and change in your life, this 15, 16 month period for everyone, I'm not shocked you're leaving Robin Hood and considering political aspirations and all these things. I think COVID has changed a lot, but this was a pretty dire circumstance 15, 16 months ago. This 61% number, this isn't good long term for where we live, where we are, right?
That's right. That's right. It's not good at all. And this thing is going to have long-term consequences. We know that. But actually what it does do is this, it gives us a chance to reimagine, right? It gives us a chance to be bold. It gives us a chance to throw the ball downfield a little bit, because we know if there is not a chance to be able to do so, when is, you know, I think about it, you know, Nestor, even with my decision, where this was actually my decision to leave Robinhood, where, you know, I think about, you know, for those who can see, but for those who are listening can't, but there's two faces that sit over my shoulder. And those are my two kids, my daughter and my son. And when I first chose to go to Robinhood, I realized I didn't really have a conversation with them about it. You know, my daughter, I think, was five at the time, four and a half. My son was two. It's not like I was sitting them down and saying, what do you all think about me commuting back and forth every day to go to New York for a job? I did it because I thought the job was also the right thing for my family. And but after this time, after this period, after this settling, with a daughter who's now nine and a son who's now seven.
So this is 4 years you did this, right? Yeah. Literally?
That's right. That's right.
48 weeks a year. I mean, literally. I mean, you say every day. I feel like literally every day. But what does that mean?
It literally means catching an early morning train and catching a late night train back. Wow. Because I wanted to as much as possible. I wanted to try to make it home to.
Well, most people would just say, all right, they're paying me. I'll move to Manhattan. I'll take the kids. We'll figure it out. Right. Like that's what most people would do. Literally.
That is what many people would have done, but they also knew for me that was a non-starter.
Well, did you bump in? I'm sure everybody's saying, "Geez, he went up there every day. He took that train to New York and back." Did you ever bump into the president when he was when he was riding back and forth? Did you ever walk through the club car and say, hey Joe, how are you?
I tell you, by the time I was doing it, he was no longer having to go back and forth on Amtrak. I saw quite a few elected officials though on that trip. But listen, Joe, President Biden, he is legendary on Amtrak. I got to know my fair share of conductors as well, but they all had Joe Biden stories.
What a great story! Hey Wes, again with a limited amount of time. You've now written, and again, folks who've listened to the show know what I think of the book, The Other Wes Moore. What year did that book come out, Wes? I can't even
2010.
Remember. 2010. So there you go again. 10 years ago, I was much younger, sitting on a beach with my niece. I think I told this story the last time you were here. It was her assigned reading for a class she was taking, and I said, "Hey, I'll read it with you." And we're basically reading it on the beach, and it's phenomenal. So again, if you have not read The Other Wes Moore, remains as relevant today, 11 years later, as it was then, either fortunately or unfortunately. Take that.
Well, you're adding to the story, Wes, so, right?
Well, now he's written, Nestor, about a subject that really changed your life, because he's written, he, along with Erica Green, former Sun reporter, outstanding Sun reporter, written a book called 5 Days that I think's now out in paperback. I know my daughter is racing through that. And she keeps saying, "Dad, I can't put this down." It's a great book by Wes. Tell Nestor and others what that book's about, because we just did the Gun Trace Task Force with Justin Fenton, and that takes our breath away every time.
Great book too.
Oh my gosh, can't put it down, Wes. And now you've written about 5 days in the wake of Freddie Gray. Give our folks the Cliff Notes version of this so they can go out and get this book.
Yeah, so 5 days is really looking at 5 days in Baltimore, all around the uprising that took place around Freddie Gray's funeral, and I look at it, and actually in many ways, especially for all the sports fans, it's bookended by baseball, right? It actually starts on the Saturday, which was the day that the Orioles were playing the Red Sox, and all the fans were asked to stay in the stadium. Because towards later innings of the game, there were protests taking place outside the stadium, and they did not want the fans coming out and meeting the protesters. So fans were asked to stay in. Then it talks about the Sunday, the Monday, which was Freddie's funeral, and the night of the night that the National Guard was actually called in, and then really the Tuesday and the Wednesday were the rebuild. And Wednesday, when I say it's bookended by baseball, Wednesday was the first time in baseball history that we played a game with no fans, where you had an official baseball game and the official attendance was zero.
By the way, still a disgrace. It'll always be a disgrace. I'll never discuss it in any other way because I live here and I watch the tank circle the city. So I just want to throw that in. So
well, no, but honestly, Nestor, I'm glad you did, because one of the things that I wanted to do with this story is to be able to tell this story through the eyes of, it turned out to be the eyes of 8 people. All of them with different perspectives and different backgrounds, where, you know, tell the story through the eyes of Greg Butler, who was a basketball star turned protester. And what was his life arc and his evolution that turned him into literally being one of the top basketball players in the city, to on that Monday night that he was literally cutting the fire hose when the fire department was trying to put a fire out inside of West Baltimore. You know, look at it through the eyes of Major Mark Partee, who grew up in West Baltimore and was a police major and running the area, in that area, one of the highest ranking African Americans in the Baltimore City Police Department, who, and I remember where I was when he told me, when he said, "Listen, I know that none of my colleagues woke up that morning with homicide on their mind. But I also know that for kids in West Baltimore, why they don't believe me."
Wes, why was, again, we got to have you back, and I hope you're staying, Brian. I hope you're listening, Brian. I know we're jammed in here today. Why did the young man, the outstanding basketball player, give our listeners, because this is what we want them to understand, help them understand the anger that takes this outstanding young man and makes him cut a fire hose?
Yeah.
What did you learn?
Greg's story was so fascinating, because you watch the arc of his life. You know, Greg Butler, and for those you know, who are in Baltimore and remember, you might remember a name, the Dawson family.
Oh, yeah.
The Dawson family was a family who were calling the police, called the police because there was drug activity outside of their home. They did it again. And one night after they called the police and said, they're selling drugs right in front of my home, their home was firebombed and killed the entire family. That was also Greg's second family. Those are his best friends. He would spend the night in their home all the time. Ironically, just happened to be that night was the night that he spent the night back with his father. That's what kept him out of the Dawson home. And Greg always lived with this idea of saying, I'm supposed to be here. Like there was a reason that I wasn't in that home. And then he becomes this, you know, remarkable athlete, gets a college scholarship. But then as he's starting, starting college, he realizes there was an error in the Baltimore City school system when it came to his GPA. And he technically didn't qualify to play college athletics by a percentage of a point. And he lost his college scholarship. Not to anything that he did, but because of an error. And so Greg was then still trying to catch his footing, but understanding just how this measured unfairness that existed in this journey in his life arc. And so he tells this beautiful story where, you know, as everything is happening, he's on the basketball courts, which, as he says, that was my refuge. The basketball courts were my refuge. And he's on the basketball courts and he's looking down and he said, for the first time I can notice when he saw smoke coming up, he said, I realized I could actually see West Baltimore from these courts I always play at. And the first thing he said, he thought to himself was, go to the smoke. And that's what brought him to where everything was happening within the Penn North area. And he's just, he's a classic example of the fact that, you know, we have such remarkable potential and remarkable hope that exists in this city. It's one of the reasons that I love the name Baltimore Positive, right? That's what exists here. Our job is to feed it, to funnel it, and to make sure that we're actually creating a place where ambition and opportunity actually have a chance to meet each other. And that did not happen in Greg Butler's case. And that's why he was a great example to watch and follow through this story.
Well, the book is 5 days, local bookstore up the street, any of the big boxes. If you want to go to Amazon, fine. But if you've ever read anything by Wes Moore, you know what a good writer he is and storyteller. And this is a story that has to be told. We have to understand. We have to be better. Wes, before we let you out of here so your staff doesn't wring our necks, everybody out there saying, okay, there's no Robin Hood. What's next for Wes Moore? You can't pick up any of these pundits who don't like to think of what might be in the future. Tell us what kind of process you're going through trying to decide what you might do next and what's going to drive that decision.
Yeah, well, I think the things that are going to drive the decision are the things that have always made my heart beat faster. Right. These issues of being able to end child poverty, things of being able to how do we speak about creating equitable, you know, economic growth? Those are things that are going to drive my next decision. And, you know, I've, you know, have been public about the fact that I'm very seriously considering, you know, running for governor of Maryland in 2022. This is my birth home. It's the place where I was raised. It's the place where we're raising our family. And I think with the way that we have approached problems before, when I look at where we are as a state, it's hard not to see that we're at an inflection point. And we've learned, in this year, just how fragile life can be and how we have got to be assertive and strong and bold when it comes to the type of solutions we're driving toward. So my process is knowing that the things that have always driven me, the issues, the people that have always driven me, you know, those are going, that is both who is going to help me make my decision as to what I'm going to do next and the things I want to do and fight for once I actually make that final decision.
What's timeline on this?
Well, I'll be the CEO of Robinhood until early May. I promised Robinhood that, and we are we've had an amazing growth run as an organization. It's important to me that we land the plane right and hand my success.
You're still training up to New York every day.
No, not well. We closed our offices in late February. We close our offices.
Say, I need some pastries from New York. If you're still coming back, I'm going to the train station.
They can mail them, I guess. But New York was really in many ways the epicenter. We had people getting sick in our office early, so we close our offices pretty early, and they're actually still closed. But I'm committed to making sure that we have a smooth landing as an organization. But pretty soon after that. I want to be public and decide what my next journey is going to be.
June 1st, we're getting a crab cake together. You, me, and the mayor over at Coco's, and we'll put that together. All right, is that good?
Done and done. Done and done.
It's over with, man. Appreciate you, Wes Moore, the other Wes Moore, author, Robin Hood, and soon to be gubernatorial candidate here. Don Mueller joining us, of course, former Baltimore County executive. Appreciate you, Wes. Keep fighting the good fight out there, and we'll see you in a couple months, all right?
I appreciate y'all. Thank you so much, guys.
Always
Thank
a great you. Visit on Baltimore Positive. Big appreciation to our friends at Wise Market for providing another Wise Conversation. We used to call them Intelligent Conversation. We need to get a new sweatshirt here from our friends at Strategic Factory. Order those Fadley's crab cakes, ship them to you. I'll be eating crab cakes all over the place. We'll be telling you more about our Crab Cake Connoisseur Club a little later on. And we'll also be making a stop at State Fair, where I'm getting some chicken and waffles this weekend. Probably get a Bloody Mary as well. I am Nestor. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. And, of course, we never stop talking. Baltimore Positive.